Welcome to Unexpected Points. I am Kevin Cole, your host. I am joined again by Rich Rebar. Those who have been listening, I had Rich on a few weeks ago. I kind of messed up the timing, quite honestly, on this. I wanted him to talk about rookies, but we're kind of a little too early for rookies. We talked about free agency, got a lot of good information there. So now I asked him to come back, and luckily for me, he's too kind to say no. So I'm exploiting Rich here. Rich Rebar of Sharp Football, Sharp Fantasy. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing real good. Yeah, we were going to talk about rookies. We got caught into the storm of free agency. You know, RIP Corey Davis, who thought that Sam Darnold was a starting quarterback for the Jets and told us that. Turned out not to be true.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of the first point of business. So we're going to talk rookie running backs today. Interesting class. We've been talking a little bit pre-show about how unique it is. I think I have some takes, like, overall on maybe from a fantasy, from a, like, a football standpoint on what's happening with running back classes and what teams could be doing. But that's a little bit separate from the fantasy angle. We'll get into that a little bit later.
I dig it.
But we can talk the Darnold trade. I mean, it's not, like, exciting, I would say, from a fantasy standpoint. There are questions as to what it means for the draft. I mean, I think the obvious thing is the Jets are taking Zach Wilson, supposedly, probably, right, at number two. And with Darnold gone, I think if we're going to talk about it from a fantasy perspective and looking at Zach Wilson, because Zach Wilson is a guy that in some early best ball drafts, I was not prioritizing him, despite the fact that he would look like he was going to be drafted earlier. I was prioritizing like a Justin Fields or a Trey Lance if I was going to throw a dart at someone, with the assumption that those guys would be running a bit more. They're bigger. You know, Zach Wilson, surprisingly to me, Zach Wilson, I think, weighed in at 212 or something like that. I thought he was going to be under 210. So he's a smaller guy. He can move. He can scoot, but he's a smaller guy. So I wasn't prioritizing him. But I want to know your take on this from a fantasy perspective. Because Wilson's there, Darnold's out, that makes me think day one starter a little bit more for Zach Wilson. Whereas we have the situation in San Francisco. We don't know what's going to happen with Jimmy Garoppolo. I kind of had this galaxy brain take for why they were going to keep him, but now they signed Chase Daniel, so maybe he's actually isn't going to go there. But anyway, so we don't really know what's going to happen in San Francisco. We have Atlanta coming up next. Could they draft someone? You have Matt Ryan there. Again, it's a weird situation where you're probably not going to play someone from day one. If you go a little bit further back, you know, I don't know who else was going to be in the mix. I don't think the Dolphins are going to be in the mix. Will Carolina trade up, and will you have Darnold there and a rookie potentially playing there? Again, a weird situation. Who's going to start day one? So what do you think from a fantasy perspective, how you're viewing maybe the non-Trevor Lawrence quarterbacks at this point after this move and Zach Wilson looking like a day one type of guy?
Yeah, I mean, this class is really interesting because there's a lot of talent here that I think is interesting from my neck of the woods and, you know, your original background, the fantasy background, just because all these guys are kind of fit that archetype that we look for. And it's just the archetype that's coming into the NFL. I mean, just more athletes are playing the quarterback position and guys that have the dual threat ability, not only to have mobility, but they're also good passers in these college systems as well. You know, that wasn't always the case for a number of years with these quarterbacks that had mobility. Now you're getting kind of that best of both worlds with both quarterbacks. I'm not as down as Wilson as I think like fantasy Twitter is. I think it's just because fantasy Twitter really likes Justin Fields, and I also have Fields ahead of Wilson, that it's kind of become sword and shield, Fields versus Wilson.
Right.
But Wilson still checks a lot of boxes for me. I mean, He's an interesting prospect for a number of levels. Well, one, you know, at a true freshman at age 19, I mean, he took over as a starter just five games into the season. It's just something we always look for, you know, got young players being able to play. He actually closed that rookie season, or not rookie season, the freshman season. He went 18 of 18 passing in his bowl game, 100% completion rate in the Idaho Potato Bowl, if anyone remembers that classic that probably was at like 12:30 in the afternoon on a Thursday.
I remember Allen's profile on Wikipedia. The one thing that was on there was Potato Bowl MVP, and I was like, "That's it." And then he just destroyed me last year. He owned me after I made fun of him for that. But anyway, go ahead.
That maybe the Idaho Potato Bowl is actually a skeleton key to unlocking some of these quarterbacks.
Right. Yeah.
But you know, his second season, he regressed, but he went through he had a shoulder injury in midseason in 2019, and he struggled that entire season. Basically, comes back last year in the COVID year and kind of just like goes bonkers. 33 touchdowns and 3 interceptions. Basically, completes 75% of his passes. He's like the most insane, like accurate passer on deep balls. I'm sure like PFF PFF has some great like deep ball stats on Zach Wilson. I believe on balls like 30 yards or further in the air, like he was like insane in this class. You know, the biggest slight against him is that, you know, at BYU, he just didn't face the level of competition as other cohorts in this class, you know, outside of Trey Lance, especially when you look at Lawrence and Fields, the competition they played regularly, especially Fields. Especially when you're looking at something like, you know, ESPN's like SP Plus Index. I mean, Fields just, that's where he shines. You know, he faced so many top caliber defenses the past years where Wilson hasn't. And you look at the COVID year where they didn't play out of conference games, you know, we didn't get BYU in any kind of situation where like they had a chance to play people. And Lance was supposed to play Oregon, the opener, and that obviously got canceled. So we didn't get to see him play a Power 5 team either. And then they just shut down everything. They're actually playing right now. That conference that Trey Lance was in. But Wilson still like checks a lot of boxes for me. The size really isn't there, but you know, he kind of reminds me a lot of Alex Smith coming out of Utah. You know, I know a lot of people say, you know, like Alex Smith, the prospect was a pretty solid prospect though.
I mean, he went number one overall. So
yeah, he went number one. He could move. He didn't have the deep ball like resume that Wilson has, but you know, he's kind of like that. He's kind of a slighter build, like you said, has some mobility. He is accurate. You know, people love the off platform throws. That's where people go crazy for him from a scouting stance, is these, because he's got a big arm and makes those out of script throws. Whereas Fields is more like methodical. When plays break down, Fields actually looks to kind of run instead of pass, where Wilson is like consistently like always trying to attack with his arm. Really the only question, like I said, is that strength of competition. But I mean, all signs point to him being a week one starter, which kind of gives him some value, especially in these early kind of best ball drafts where he's still kind of going, you know, in like that QB 30-ish area to kind of take some swings on.
I mean, I think people are pretty sour on the Jet situation generally, probably too, in coming in there. And, you know, it's always tough to predict when you're going to have like these type of jumps. But sometimes it's not like a linear progression if they get the right pieces in there. They got some of that on the offensive line, but they didn't really go crazy there. Do you think the thing with Fields is, do you think it's not only, it's like kind of media too, at least a decent amount of media, not only fantasy guys, but media. Do you think we're having like kind of some anchor bias here? We are anchored on Fields as being the number two guy, and now we're just not coming off of him where I don't know where he's going to go. Like, we really don't know. We're getting heavy vibes that he might be like QB5 on a lot of people's boards in the NFL. And it just doesn't seem like that's really being reflected into people's opinions outside of the NFL and maybe some really connected guys who are going to say stuff like that and then get yelled at on Twitter.
I'm actually okay with that though, because I mean, I think that the NFL guys that they have let slide or been kind of sour on through this process, like they've shown that they've been consistently kind of wrong on. I mean, Justin Herbert last year. I mean, the book remains to be written on Daniel Jones. And then obviously Josh Allen, and he had a historic turnaround. I don't think we can expect for a lot of quarterbacks to do, but a lot of people got picked apart through the process, and these guys that kind of slip from like a fantasy reasons, I think people have kind of come around and said like, we still know Fields is going to go high enough. He's going to go to a situation where he's probably going to have a really good chance to start year one. Even if it's not week one, he's going to probably push someone to start. He would have to go somewhere to where he's like really buried, like Atlanta, where like you just like Matt Ryan is like established. He's a really good quarterback still, in the top half of quarterbacks in the NFL still. But, you know, like going to like New England to Cam Newton, like I would bet on Fields to surpass a guy like Newton if that happened. If he was to go to Denver and Drew Lock, like I would anticipate Fields to start sooner than later. If Carolina somehow dipped back in and, you know, it's just him versus Darnold, assuming they get rid of Bridgewater, I would still bet on Justin Fields, you know, to be a starter sooner than later. Really, like Atlanta is the only spot where you wouldn't. So, I mean, I'm still pretty high, even if he does slide a little bit below, just because, like I said, the typical reasons that he's sliding, the NFL has kind of shown to be consistently wrong on those guys that they kind of pick apart through this process.
Okay. Let's talk about San Francisco for a second here, because I didn't tape last week, and so obviously the trade up, I don't necessarily want to get into the parameters of whether or not it was a good trade up, this and that. I mean, we all know what they're doing. They're saying we want to upgrade at the position here. I guess the question would be for them, do you think Garoppolo has a chance to stick? Some people think it's ludicrous that he would be considered, you know, that he's going to be there next year, or that he won't be traded. I mean, there's word out there. They said oh, they want a first round pick for him. I mean, whatever, they're posturing, right? They want something for him. Now, at this point in the cycle, I kind of wonder from his perspective, like, where is he going to go? Or, like, where is he going to go and be a starter? Will he take a pay cut? There's a potential there. And I do think from San Francisco's perspective, and like I said, this has been complicated a little bit by the fact that they just signed Chase Daniel. So I don't know what that means for Garoppolo. But I do think from San Francisco's perspective, if you're willing to pay a little bit extra for Garoppolo, you do have a team that can compete, right? This is not a number three overall pick type of team. This is not the Jets, you know? This is not the Jacksonville Jaguars. This is a team that went to the Super Bowl 2 years ago. This is a team with a lot of veteran players on. This is a team you invested, you know, a ton of capital into Trent Williams to pay him a lot of money at 33 years old to be your left tackle. From a locker room perspective and other things, you know, there's risk here if you say we're going to draft whoever it is, Mac Jones or someone, let's say, because that's what everyone's saying nowadays. We're going to bring in Mac Jones. We're going to trade away or we're going to let go of Jimmy Garoppolo. And he just sticks up the joint weeks 1 through 3. Like, you're kind of in a world of pain right there from a franchise perspective and maybe from a locker room perspective. So I do wonder if maybe there's a chance that they would keep him around, because you could also rehabilitate his value a bit. I mean, I think that they're 22-8 with him in the regular season. They're 24-9 when you count the playoff run that they had there. I mean, that is a 12-win team according to the new 17-game schedule. You know, that's like a 12-5 team. That's a playoff team. He's been really good. He's had these injury problems, so maybe if he can actually get through some games, maybe you can get an Alex Smith type of situation where you can rehabilitate him and then send him off the next year. Do you think there's any chance that Garoppolo sticks?
Yeah, it's definitely non-zero. I mean, the 49ers, one thing that the—
I forgot, you're a Niners fan also.
No, I mean, I grew up a Niners fan, but, you know, the fantasy industry has kind of just, like, removed me from, like, liking anything.
Okay.
Being exposed to every fan base ruined being a part of a fan base for me.
Yeah. You get the worst representations of fandom, for sure, being on Twitter.
I actually, when they went to the Super Bowl, too, it was confirmed, because I actually felt nothing at all, and I knew it was confirmed. I was completely dead inside. But it's definitely non-zero, because what the 49ers have done in recent years, especially with Parag Marathi, they structure their contracts so uniquely compared to the rest of the NFL. You know, and Garoppolo is like this wide open like outcome this year. So if he stays, he's $26.4 million under the cap, on the cap, which isn't a big deal. You just keep him for a year and whatever. But he basically, you know, would only be $2.8 million in dead money to trade. He has a no trade clause. But if you were to say, hey, this team's going to make you a starter, like Jimmy Garoppolo would probably be like, yeah, I'm going to go start with someplace that wants me. And right. I'm part of a long— I have a chance to make it like be part of a long-term process. I don't think that that's like a big hurdle, a no trade clause. But the unique contract structure, like, really is kind of an open book here. And you know, the cap hit this year isn't a big deal, like, cause it's already money you're counting on. The question is, if they do start him and go into the season, how long does he last?
Right.
If he ends up playing like he did against the last time we saw him on the field against Seattle, or like against Miami, you know, when he came back from that ankle injury, that guy's not going to last long. Like, he's just not going to be on the field long. And when you take these rookie quarterbacks, there's a reason why these rookie quarterbacks play more and more now than ever, is because there's just consistent pressure to turn the leaf over. What's the next thing, you know? And if you're playing around 500 football, if then the 49ers drop a couple games, the schedule's not out yet, so we don't know like how the early season schedule outlook lies. But, you know, if they start, you know, 2-3 or 2-4 or 3-3, like, there's going to be heat on saying, hey, we're playing around on 500 ball. We've got this guy we traded 3 first round picks for. We took him at pick 3. Like, it's time. Like, it's time to take a look. And there's just going to be that constant pressure. And I don't know if Garoppolo is good enough to play himself above that station like they did 2 years ago, because one, the defense was just insane that year, and it was something we can't count on happening, especially with this current defensive roster that's nowhere near as good as that roster was a couple years ago. Even though they are still a competitive team, we don't expect them to be a bottom dwelling team that deserved to be picking where they were, which was, you know, at pick 12 and then traded up for pick 3. But I just don't believe that Garoppolo is the kind of talent that's going to outkick that coverage again. I think that was kind of a perfect storm 2 years ago. And that he's kind of like, you know, a baseline, above baseline starter in the NFL. He hasn't even played a full season in the NFL, or one so far in the NFL. So I just don't think he'll be able to really keep a guy off the field. It's definitely non-zero, but I think right now, like you said, it's all posturing. It's kind of what they honestly get, because he's clearly not part of their long-term plan.
Right. Well, yeah, that's obvious. I mean, you don't trade up to three if you're not part, if you're part of the long-term plan. I think that's true. I mean, another reason why I'm thinking, okay, I agree with you that if things go sideways, they're going to make a move. But I think people kind of underappreciate how much that variable plays into things, because you'll see things, you'll say, oh, this guy is NFL ready, this guy is not NFL ready. You know, they're going to hold him out or not. What's really going to determine more than anything is, yeah, there's definitely like a camp thing and they see how they look. But a lot of the times these decisions are made before they even see them at all. I mean, think about Joe Burrow last year. I mean, they had nobody there. So they were going to play him day one, whether he came in or not. Obviously, we had the virtual thing, so it was a little bit different. But a lot of times the big variable is if the team is going sideways, if they're losing games, then they bring in the guy. And obviously they're getting, you know, information and evidence on whether or not a quarterback is ready. But I mean, how good are these guys at assessing whether someone's ready or not? Justin Herbert was not ready until Tyrod Taylor got stabbed. He got Caesared, and then they brought in Justin Herbert. Deshaun Watson was not ready. And they had, right. You know, there, even you even had DeAndre Hopkins saying that he didn't want him to be the starter from what they had seen there. And he was kind of brought in, midway after all this declaration that he was not going to play. They were going to go with his name is escaping me, right, Tom Savage. And you know, midway through the first half, they're like, we're done with this, like this is over immediately, and they force their hand there. So I do think there's an element of at least San Francisco's in a better than typical spot for a quarterback to survive purely off of winning games, whether he's playing excellent ball or not. And, you know, Debo Samuel's now in his third season. Ayuk's coming into his second season. You got George Kittle. You got Trent Williams there. You have a decent team. Like, you know, they got some decent surroundings there. So there may be enough to keep Garoppolo afloat for a little bit longer than some people think. But that kind of presumes that he'll be around there. So I think that's interesting. Let's flip to Carolina for a second. So how much do we care about this from Carolina's perspective? Not only whether Sam Darnold will be any good, which is highly questionable, but what this means for, you know, Robbie Anderson, for DJ Moore, maybe for Christian McCaffrey. I don't know if it really affects Christian McCaffrey that much there. For those guys there, not that Bridgewater was good, but he started off kind of hot, actually, I mean, for Bridgewater. And then they really limped in at the end of the season. I think that's when they just determined they need to make a change. So do we care about this change that much outside of, you know, what it could potentially mean for Sam Darnold just being an unknown in a new circumstance?
I mean, Carolina was a top 10 offense at DVOA basically for 2/3 of the season. And like you said, yeah, it just really came off the rails to kind of close. I think that's what kind of, you know, forced the hand. And Teddy got hurt too at the end of the season too. So, I mean, this is a really weird. I've like really kicked a lot of ideas around this. It's a really weird trade. There are really weird parameters around this trade. You know, so on one hand, if the Carolina makes this trade because the staff was really into Sam Darnold. They think, you know, Adam Gase is basically, you know, clown shoes, couldn't figure out how to develop, you know, a quarterback. There's kind of a benefit of the doubt to give them some optimism. You know, obviously the argument to make for Darnold is going to be easy. People are going to say Mike Davis, Robbie Anderson, you know, Teddy Bridgewater, you know, all these guys had 1,000 yards this first year in this offense where there's no offseason. You know, Joe Brady can spin gold. They can turn this around. And then people will say, well, Ryan Tannehill did, even though Ryan Tannehill was actually better than anything Sam Darnold has shown. Even Blake Bortles was better than anything Sam Darnold has shown to date over his first 3 years. But it's going to be real easy. The spin forward is easy. Now, if they made this trade just because, like, David Tepper has no patience, he demanded that they have to go out and get a new quarterback. Remember, they were in on the Matthew Stafford deal. The coaches really didn't like their draft options, didn't think they'd be have someone they liked at 8 after the 49ers trade up. And they're kind of just like forced into this Darnold trade from Tepper's end, then that's probably a problem. Right. You know, you have to pick up the fifth year based on what you get. You know, a lot of people saw this as like a low risk move and a high reward. I don't really see it that way. I mean, you're counting on Sam Darnold to be good in 2021 based on this trade. Like there's no competition. You make this trade. He is the starting quarterback based on you picking up the fifth year option, what you gave up, and you're counting him to be good. I mean, what if you're back in the same boat next year and it's just you're doing the same thing with Darnold you did with Teddy this year, and now you lose a top 40 pick because assuming you're back in the similar boat. Very peculiar trade because I'm one of these people. I don't know where you come out, but like I just don't think the Ryan Tannehill turnarounds, the Josh Allen turnarounds are going to be as commonplace as everyone is just assuming they are. We're starting to see a lot of people compare Daniel Jones's situation to Josh Allen's, you know, after they signed Kenny Galladay. I just don't really buy that. Like, it's just going to, we're going to see a lot of these quarterbacks just immediately flip the switch. And when you look at Darnold last year, yeah, he, you know, he hasn't had weapons over his rookie contract. He was saddled with Adam Gase, but from a clean pocket last year, he was one of the worst quarterbacks in the NFL. You know, from a clean pocket, only two other, he had negative EPA from a clean pocket. Only Nick Foles and Dwayne Haskins were with him. And then from a yards per attempt perspective, from a clean pocket, he was ahead of only Mike Glennon and Nick Foles. Like, on the same token, Sam Darnold has literally shown us like no reason for optimism outside of like a couple plays. Like, there's been no consistency. It's hard to grasp. Like, could there be a turnaround? Am I still open to the, to being optimistic? Yeah, I'm pretty pragmatic. You know, Carolina's got some pieces I like. I like DJ Moore. I think Robbie Anderson's a solid, you know, ancillary player. Obviously, they've got Christian McCaffrey. I kind of like the coaching staff. You know, that's TBD, but I like what Joe Brady's resume has on it so far. So, yeah, I'm a little optimistic. I just think it's a really weird trade. I think it's really weird that it's just be starting to become commonplace that all these guys are going to turn it around, even though we've just seen, you know, Josh Rosen and Dwayne Haskins be completely sunk cost, but everyone's still looking for the pie in the sky. Very, very weird, and I haven't really wrapped my head about like a firm stance on it.
Yeah, so I think from, I've heard some perspective saying Teddy Bridgewater is a better quarterback than Sam Darnold, and now your opinion on the Panthers is lower maybe than it would have been. I've heard that take, and yeah, I mean, I guess there's, again, I feel like this is another like range of outcomes type of situation. Mm-hmm. Maybe your median projection is that they're worse with Sam Darnold, and I think that's fair. If you want to do that, I think that's fair. There's just more unknown to Sam Darnold than there is to Teddy Bridgewater. And then I've heard some people rebut that by saying Sam Darnold has thrown more passes in his career than Teddy Bridgewater has. Yeah, but it's just like over many years. And you can say with the physical skills, I think there's some limitations to Bridgewater that are fairly obvious, right? And even play, if you go all the way back to draft position, I mean, Darnold was probably like in a lot of people's minds a number one overall pick type of guy. Although, in the comparison to Josh Allen, I think the big thing that sticks out to me is, like, there's no thing about Sam Darnold from a physical standpoint that's close to Josh Allen. Like, he's big, but he's not as big as Josh Allen. He's not slow, but he's not, like, fast like Josh Allen. He doesn't have that great of an arm, quite honestly. Like, and then Josh Allen obviously has this cannon and what he can do there. So I think that kind of really kills the Josh Allen type of comparison going forward. And then the Tannehill type of comparison, what's interesting about Tannehill is he actually graded pretty well from PFF. He was one of these guys who had a vast, like, divergence. The biggest divergence we've seen, I think Baker Mayfield was close his first couple seasons, but the biggest divergence PFF has had between grades and efficiency on an EPA per play perspective or per dropback perspective was Ryan Tannehill. So there was something there. Sam Darnold has just been bad. Like, grades, I think he's been like the only quarterback's been worse than him over the last couple of seasons, or like Dwayne Haskins maybe is the only guy who's been worse than him if you look for over the last few years. And yeah, there just haven't been any flashes. I mean, I would say week 1 2018, his first game was probably like his peak. I think he peaked against the Detroit Lions that game where he threw a few touchdowns and people were talking about him. So we haven't seen much since then. What do you think about this idea of them maybe drafting a quarterback because it's weird because them making this move would make you think that they don't think the quarterback who they want is going to be available, or else why make this move right now unless you're scared someone else is going to go in there and get Sam Darnold, I guess, before the draft?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about last time on the show, you know, a few weeks ago, we had talked about the Dolphins, you know, being a situation. And I'm on your side on this conversation, just until we see teams do it. Like, it's, you know, minds are still going to be blown and there'll be resistance. But, like, if you could take a top quarterback prospect and you're not in a position to kind of, you know, win in the NFL right now, like, just take the quarterback. They're assets. Yeah. They're currency. You know, their currency. You know, and if I'm the Panthers and I'm there at 8 and, like, even Trey Lance is there and he's maybe not, I'm still just going to take him. I'm just going to take him. Because what can Carolina take at pick 8 that is going to even, like, move the needle for you to say, like, they've won, got a legitimate shot to even make the playoffs or, like, really actually be a contender instead of just backdooring the playoffs? There isn't one. So why not just take the currency? And you've got, you know, you've got this in your pocket. If Darnold flames, one, you can just play the kid. And then you know, if Darnold is good, you have options. You have options to maneuver, you know, your personnel. So yeah. I mean, I'm on your side in that argument. I wish we would see more teams be aggressive and do it. I mean, even the Dolphins at six, they only moved three spots down. Obviously, they moved to 12 and then back up, but it's like, man, they still should take a quarterback if one's there. I mean, it's just not going to happen. And I think Carolina has given us a signal that they're not going to take a quarterback and they're probably being on one of these offensive linemen that are for sure going to slide now. Because even if the Bengals take Sewell at five, you probably have Slater there at eight. The offensive line was horrendous. They've kind of just been – and they've been all over the offensive line market this offseason, just signing guys to one-year deals like that aren't really particularly really good offensive linemen. So I think that's the early signal, but I'm totally on your side of this argument. I would love to see teams treat – I know we have, like, the fantasy background. And it's easier for us to say stuff like that, and we're not in a window where, like, we have to start stacking wins. But, like, if you are not a team that's going to win like Carolina, they are not a contender, at least in my mind. I'm sure you probably are not far off from that either. Like, just stack assets.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that makes the most sense. Well, I think the fundamental problem with the viewpoint against – getting another quarterback. I mean, there's the ridiculous stuff about, you know, chemistry. You have two quarterbacks, you have none. You're giving up on the first quarterback. I mean, if you can play it and not give up on the first guy, that it depends on who it is. But I mean, people hold on to hope too long for that first quarterback. So that's one of the big problems. But the second big problem, I think, it's just like, it's okay to waste sometimes, you know, like you're locking in waste. And I think people don't like that. People don't like to say, now, you know, if you get, well, you're not necessarily locking in waste, but people think you're locking in waste, right? They think you're duplicating. You don't need this as a position. It's the same thing with wasting money on someone. It's just like teams waste a ton of money all the time. Look at the dead money that's going off of the boards on all these different teams. Team waste draft picks. Teams waste top 10 draft picks. Not because they make a stupid move, but they just bust. Like, these guys bust. So why not, like, use the draft pick on someone where the upside is so, so huge? Because guess what? The guy you're going to take, you know, I know you're going to say to yourself, oh, you're taking Penei Sewell, we're taking, you know, whoever else, made Jamar Chase. Those guys could bust. Like, these guys bust all the time in that sort of range. So you're not guaranteed to fit these pieces together. And it's just, you have to be willing to say, we can waste a little bit, but it's like wasting in a smart way, because teams waste in dumb ways all the time and no one seems to be worried about it because there was this potential to fit all these pieces together in wasting in a dumb way.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I'm your preacher's choir here. I'm 100% on board with, like, this take and this approach. I would love to see some teams really start to deploy it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it'll be interesting. But we'll see. I think the Darnold thing is also funny. I mean, if they bring in a quarterback, if they do draft a quarterback and he gets to play and he looks okay, then I think everything will be fine. But you're right, man. If this Darnold thing goes sideways, man, it's going to be a rough offseason, because you're going to be talking about that second round pick, which will be in the 30s, that you lost. You're going to be talking about that $18.8 million you have guaranteed to Sam Darnold next year. You're going to be talking about all those things. And it's going to be like, that's when everyone starts coming after each other. That's when Tepper and Rule, who were like symbiotic, lost at birth, identical twins, are going to come after each other next offseason. Well, we'll see how it plays out. All right, let's get into these rookies. Let's get into these rookie running backs. I looked through your kind of pro day rankings. It's an interesting class. Let's talk a little bit about process here. When you're putting those together, now that we have the pro day stuff, number one, how much does the measurables, let's call it, pro day stuff, for running backs, maybe we can also say age, whether they're underclassmen. I'll kind of throw that into the same kind of measurable bucket, because it's not something based on contextual production performance. And then you have production. And then the third big thing I'll say is, like, expected draft position. How are we looking at those three buckets when you're assessing this class, or just running backs generally?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I'm still, you know, production driven first, but I'm using the athletic profiles. You know, a lot of the correlation chasers, like, there as a one-off, like, there is no combine metric that one-off signals fantasy points. There just really isn't. But I mean, I'm still looking for, like, an accumulation, you know, my home cook spark score. I'm sure you have one too, kind of athletic grade. You know, mine personally is, like, you know, all weight adjusted, you know, speed, agility, explosion, but it doesn't really factor into the actual prospect grade a ton. It's very minuscule. What I use the athletic profiles, the combine and the pro days for, is to kind of confirm archetype. because you know, I'm a big archetype guy. We talk about all the time at wide receiver. I know you've just written an article on Elijah Moore and the profile that he has. I'm very big in the same way because archetypes predict usage, and then in turn usage predicts fantasy points. And I'm looking for kind of the symmetry. I'm looking for stuff that is an outlier or stuff that confirms what I already thought on guys like a Kenneth Gainwell, things like that from the athletic side. And then if something pops, I want to go back and say like, oh, I need to go back and look at this, like a guy like Nico Collins, who isn't a running back, but you know, whatever. But yeah, that's what I'm using these pro days and combines for, kind of just to confirm archetypes. But draft capital is really the thing that matters the most. I mean, draft capital is literally the only thing at the running back position that has like literally any correlation to like year 1 through 3 fantasy points. And it's not like the greatest, but like it significantly outweighs anything else. So, I mean, we're really just kind of waiting to see kind of what we've got on the board here. But I do like to reference like my pre-draft grades. I mean, last year, like my model liked James Robinson more than Clyde Edwards-Helaire. Now, am I going to rank James Robinson or Clyde Edwards-Helaire like post-draft? Absolutely not. But because my model liked him a lot, yeah, I just like took some shots in like the fourth round, fifth round rookie drafts. Just like, what the hell? My model liked them. I'll just see what happens. And you know, that pays off. Now that's a pie in the sky outcome that played out. It doesn't always go like that, you know, when I throw these late round darts. But you know, I like to go back and reference, you know, kind of the grades this year. Obviously from a grade perspective, it's not great. There's not a lot here to really like at the top. Obviously, we've got the top three guys. There are some ancillary guys that do kind of show up, but then they come with either red flags. The thing about this class is we just don't know, like, really where the hell any of these guys are going to go. Last year, we had a pretty good feel. Like, we've got this bucket of guys that even if the NFL suppresses the value of running backs, and we've had such a really strong influx of running back talent over the past 5 years that there are kind of more good running backs than there are jobs in the NFL. We still knew that bucket of prospects was strong and was going to go, even by being depressed, like in like the 30 to like 60 range. You know, we kind of knew like those guys were going to go there. This year we've got three guys that we kind of feel are going to go into that bucket. Maybe someone squeezes and goes a little higher because it's thinner at the top than it was last year. There's not as much supply as there's, you know, demand for some of these teams. Like if you're a team like the Steelers and you're like, we have to have a running back, but if you don't take one at 24, like you might not have one at 55 because there's only three guys really. So I mean, like we're really kind of sketchy on that afterwards, like where you might like pick out whoever flavor guy you like. You might like Trey Sermon. You might like Michael Carter. You might like Kenneth Gainwell. You might like Khalil Herbert, whatever. Those guys could go anywhere. Like there's really no kind of surface area to kind of expectations for those guys. Sermon could be a third rounder. He could be a fifth rounder. You wouldn't blink, right? Like if Sermon went in the fifth round, like you wouldn't blink. No. So it's kind of a weird class in that regard where the secondary kind of tiers are kind of scattershot. We kind of want to see where the draft capital, the investment is. I don't really care much about like landing spot initially, like some do. I care more about the capital because we tend to overrate landing spots. There's just too much fluidity in landing spots in the NFL. I think to accurately portray from a fantasy stance of being able to, from a projection stance, tend not to get caught up into that wake too much. Remember people did it with Keyshawn Vaughn last year, really hard to be consistent.
He's breaking out this year though, according to,
I mean, Bruce Arians told us, I heard Traquan is breaking out for the fifth year in a row too, from Saints brass. but yeah, this class is really unique on the secondary levels. Cause we want to see the investment kind of where these guys go. And then it's a weird archetype class in general. I mean, even these high guys, I brought up Kenneth Gainwell, I brought up Michael Carter. These are not guys that project to be kind of high touch NFL players on any level. And I finally bit the bullet and moved Trey Sermon up in my rankings, even though I think there's a real gap between the top three and the RB4. But just because when I look at Kenneth Gainwell and Michael Carter's profiles, it just screams committee back at the NFL level. And we can get into some of the semantics of each individual prospect if you want, but top down, that's kind of where I'm at.
yeah, I mean, I think it's not exactly, I mean, I think the wide receiver class has a lot more talent, but the things that are parallels to me is that the college game has moved in a certain direction, right? So you have a lot of wide receivers where you're going to say someone like an Elijah Moore, who everyone loves, and then you could say, well, yeah, he's got the speed, he's got the quickness and that, but then look at these other guys you may be able to get later, like a Jalen Darden or a Shai Smith or a Dwayne Eskridge or one of these guys. You can say, you know, there's like these substitutes. And I think that comes true of this running back class, too, is that you have the game has moved in a certain direction. You have these guys who are, let's say, between 100 and sometimes to 190, sometimes lower, but more like 195, let's say, to 210. They don't quite get over 210, which is maybe when things get interesting. But they're productive. They can catch the ball. They're valuable, I think, from an NFL perspective. But from a fantasy perspective, you start to comp these guys to what we've seen in the past, and it's just a little bit like DOA. It's just like you just don't – what are they going to do going forward if they don't really have a profile of being that committee back? What they're really most likely to do is get in a situation where you've seen with some smaller backs in the past, whether it's been like a Justin Forsett or Ahmad Bradshaw or one of these other later guys, Leon Washington, maybe some of these guys, where they get a chance for a while and they can produce, even if they're small, because it doesn't matter maybe as much as some people think. But it's not a long-standing sort of thing where they're going to be that guy. So I feel like that's where this falls in. And I think from an NFL team's perspective, obviously, you know, running backs don't matter, everything like that, right? That plays into it, but can't you just piece together backfields with some of these guys that are a little bit discounted and maybe they weigh 10 pounds less than some of these other guys, but like you're going to use a second round pick on someone versus a fifth round pick on someone. It just seems nuts in some ways on how they can produce. So I guess that would be my take, is like, why not build like I feel like Aaron Jones is a great example of somebody where, you know, he didn't really fit he wasn't really big enough probably to be that kind of workhorse sort of back. They never really used him like a super workhorse, but you combine him, you sprinkle in some Jamal Williams, mm-hmm. some other stuff, you can build that together. Now you pay him again, which is maybe a mistake going forward, but like I like piecing that together as a guy who I believe Jones was a fifth round pick, right? So you got like, you can get him very, very late in the draft. So, but anyway, let's get into it. So I assume the top three guys that you have are going to be the top three that everyone has. Is Najee Harris your number one guy?
He is. Just checks too many boxes outside of, you know, the red flags for Najee Harris are obviously going to be pounded home that, you know, not early declare an older prospect, but I think some of that is when you kind of dig under the hood circumstantially actually made a benefit of him. I definitely believe that he's regarded higher in this draft class than he would have been if he came out last year. I think he did play his cards right. And then from like an on-field perspective, and obviously too, you combine too, that he went to Alabama, played behind Josh Jacobs for a stretch. Obviously they've just cranked out running back after running back at that university. But then when you look at a guy that's that big and then has the receiving profile that he has, those guys don't really come around very often. A guy that's, you know, 230 pounds, you know, interestingly, you say, well, if, man, he's 6'3", 230 pounds. We just easily draw the corollary of the line to Derrick Henry previously, but the receiving profile for Najee Harris is just so sensational. I mean, he has more receptions in his final collegiate season for a back over 225 pounds than anyone but Saquon Barkley and Steven Jackson since 2000. You know, it's really hard to get a guy that is just checks all those boxes, can play all three downs. And from a fantasy stance, what I mean, you know, and an NFL, am I getting this excited? No. But from a fantasy stance, I know he's going to get goal line carries. He can catch the ball and he can be a high workload back. Even if he's not efficient, like all those things add up to being a good fantasy running back. So that's kind of where it's hard for me to move off of him. He does, like, because of his weird profile, because a lot of players that look like Najee Harris just go pro before the point that Najee Harris has gone pro. So all of his comps are kind of weird and older comps because it's before, like, early declares were really part of the process. And then you add that receiving profile in. He does come up with a lot of weird comps that are more throwback comps and not as more recent than you see for some of these other backs in this class. But I do believe that Najee Harris actually did play his cards right. And it's always hard to knock these guys from our perspective for going back to school, because we don't know why they go back to school. And then you had this weird COVID situation. But I do think that he actually did play his situation correctly returning to school. And I believe he'll have higher draft capital in this class than he would have a year ago.
Yeah. So for Harris, it's interesting because you're right. If you bring age into the equation, it kind of skews the comps. When I'm looking at some of these comps, mm-hmm. like I started getting some guys like Daniel Thomas or someone like that, who may be part of that bucket.
I had like Toby Gerhart was in there.
Yeah, Gerhart. Well, I mean, this is what it comes into. And this is maybe a question I should ask. Like, we don't have the pro day stuff, right? So Gerhart, like, he's a negative, but dude was like pretty freakish, right? He ran like a 4.5 flat or something like that, I think, at 230 something pounds. So he was a big dude. We don't really know for Harris what he runs. Does that matter to you at all?
Not really, like I said, because I know what kind of arc, I'm pretty confirmed on what kind of archetype back he is. based on his production and size. And that's really all I care about for these backs from a physical stance about Arctic. Like take like a Ramondre Stevenson, like who's a similar physical profile back, you know, 6'1", 227, but has like really no receiving pedigree. You know, is not a great athlete. That like to me, that signals like he's probably locked into being like an early down banger, could be a goal line guy as a threat. But like, you need that specific archetype of player for fantasy to run into scoring situations. He's not gonna probably catch a lot of passes. Or Harris immediately has that out in comparison to him, without even knowing his physical profile. We know he can catch the football and has that kind of, you know, acumen on his resume, where Stevenson is like in the Jordan Howard corollary, where it's like we have to run into this specific outcome every week to get fantasy points.
I mean, when I plug everything in there, I mean, I'm just still guessing that he's 230, and I'm just like guessing he's going to be,
he did weigh in at the Senior Bowl at least.
So I'm just guessing he's going to be like a 4.55, maybe even a little bit higher than that sort of guy. He looks pretty good. I mean, it's this weird thing with Alabama where he doesn't get a chance to get like your 25 carries a game, because they just don't, you know, it's just hard when you're there to really be that sort of guy. But the receiving work, like you mentioned, I mean, I have his share of receptions for the games that he played, I guess this last year, over 13%, which is pretty elite. So kind of looking at other guys, I mean, he does kind of comp to like a Trent Richardson, quite honestly, if he's not a number three overall pick type of guy. But
again, we're comparing the guy to the prospect, though.
Yeah,
too.
Like, yeah, exactly. But that's another problem with prospect comps, period. You have two different problems. Number one, you comp a guy to a great prospect who failed and people are upset about it. And then if you have another guy who's a little bit later, the guys you're going to comp them to are just not going to be exciting, right? They're just not going to be exciting, even if they're accurate. So everyone wants you to comp. Like, I had this thing where recently I did this piece on Nico Collins, who you mentioned earlier, and I had this long list of comps. Now, his top comp was Miles Boykin, right? And later on in his comps, stretching it a lot, you know, from a speed perspective, where like DK Metcalf and some other guys started to show up. So when the tweet went out on it, it's like, oh, DK Metcalf. So it's like, whoa, calm down here, people. What's going on? Because no one wants to see Miles Boykin, right? No one wants to see Miles Boykin. Even though Boykin was like an athletic freak who was taken in the third round, like there was something to be excited about, I would say, for Boykin. But no one wants to see that. So yeah, I think like, but Richardson was a top five pick, so maybe it's a little bit in a different category. But he is someone who kind of does it all. And you're right, we've kind of gone a long way from some of these older, like, we're, at least we're not in the Bishop Sankey sort of number one pick overall, I mean, number one running back pick type of situation. But yeah, this class generally, you're going to have Harris is really the one guy that's going to check all the boxes. Now, if we're going to go for the second guy, for Travis Etienne, it's... The big thing for him was, again, for this pro day, because that's all we can really obsess about is what's going on recently, is that he weighed in at 215 pounds. Now, whether or how much we believe that or not, is he going to play at that weight or not? I think those are always questions. But when I was doing comping based upon that, I mean, it really opened up a lot better comps when you start putting the 215 in there. I mean, some of them people get upset about that they come in there because they're not going to play, you know. People are going to say, oh, well, he's not, you know, I forget who was in there. I think it was like Marshawn Lynch or someone like that came in there. They're like, oh, he's not, you know, he's not Marshawn Lynch. That's ridiculous.
And we know that.
and we know that. But, you know, Lynch was like in the 213 or 240. Like, he wasn't necessarily weighing in any bigger. But guys like that start to approach in the profile where maybe it's not really appropriate. So what did that matter at all to you that he was coming in at 215 as far as how you view him? And maybe the real problem with him is whether he can be that kind of workhorse sort of guy.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely helped him out from like a, you know, a comp perspective. I think one of the biggest surprises of this, you know, period in context of this running back class was Etienne being bigger than Javonte Williams. Like, no, I think don't think anyone had a bet on that happening at all. Like, and you know, especially stylistically. And I don't think that they'll play, be used, deployed in a similar capacity that dictates out. I think Etienne's definitely going to be a guy that's going to be a splash play guy, you know, a lot of outside runs, you know, using the passing game. I mean, one of the most explosive playmakers in this class by far, but it did help his comps out a lot. You know, you start to get guys like, you know, Cam Akers and D'Angelo Williams and Donald
Brown. Cam Akers, I think, was came up first on mine when I was doing
on yours. Yeah, I had Donald Brown, D'Angelo Williams, Akers was in the top five, Ontario Smith, Cadillac Williams. Because remember, too, he's also a guy that went back to school for a senior year and was an older prospect. I don't know if he helped himself out like Najee Harris did. I think he's probably going to have similar draft capital than he would have last year, especially coming off of the 3 years he had at Clemson prior to last year. But remember, too, Clemson had like a ridiculous amount of offensive linemen leave last year. They had like a bunch of guys go pro. But his receiving acumen's too good. I think, like you said, he'll probably play a little lower than what his combine weight was. I believe he got that up to kind of help his draft stock, but like he did it. He was successful at doing it and it worked. So I'm not going to knock him on that. I just think his receiving and splash play upside and his total resume still gives him the edge for me over Williams. I'm not down on Williams. If someone has Williams higher, like I'm not going to push really back on it. I think that Williams is fine, but I think that the Etienne's overall resume and receiving profile are just too strong for me to ignore. And if from a model stance, he just checks out because of those reasons to warrant that wider running back two kind of spot from an upside stance.
Yeah. I mean, I think I was subject to this a lot initially, looking at Javonte Williams as maybe just thinking from watching them play that he was more of that guy that you would want. And it's funny, we have the stat of like forced missed tackles. So they're actually kind of similar on forced missed tackles. They're kind of doing it in different ways. I would say Etienne is like is really bursting through, breaking arm tackles, sometimes lowering the shoulder and doing what he has to do, but not like Williams, where you'd have these plays where he's just running through people over and over again. So the 215 thing, I think that really does boost him up a lot. I figure like Etienne's a guy for me where I probably should be higher on him than I am. So like if I was going to take the approach, which is probably the best approach, which is, you know, trust the data, trust what you know, I would be pretty high on him and maybe have him like almost close to, not like a 1B to Harris, but close to that sort of area. But I don't know if I'm necessarily going to get there with him. And he ran pretty well at his pro day, so I thought that was all good there. Now for Williams, I assume that's like the 1, 2, 3 tier. What's your opinion on Williams, and has it changed at all as far as where he could be vis-a-vis the other two?
Well, yeah. I mean, I wrote one of a long article at RotoViz, gosh, this is years ago, about, you know, committee backs in college and how they tend to stay committee backs in the NFL. I haven't really gone back and revisited it, you know, kind of with these most recent classes. But with Williams coming in basically 15 pounds lighter than what we thought, you know, he was listed at 227. Yeah. And when he comes and then he's 212. That to me also screams like committee, like it could be the potential to oscillate either way, right? He could be. He, at 212, like you said, he'd be Aaron Jones-ish. You can get more workload, maybe not be a 350 touch guy, but still be like a 290, 300 touch guy. And that's all we need in fantasy. He could be in that area, or, you know, he can go the other way and be like a 200 touch guy. Like, and that's what he was in college. And obviously he played with another back that is coming out in this class, but he was outproduced by Michael Carter, you know, pretty consistently over his, you know, tenure at UNC. So it does bring up a little bit more of a red flag than I think it would have had. Cause I was the same way. I came in the process thinking, all right, well, I'm going to have Harris and Williams is like a mini tier, because those are the guys that project to be like three down guys, 220 pound backs that can catch the ball, have scoring opportunities. And then when, you know, him and Etienne have more of the same physical profile, it's like, okay now. Cause you brought up like, you know, too, about like not knowing what these guys play at. Like if you're listed at 212 or 215, like, you know, that's kind of like that strike zone. Like we don't know like what really Aaron Jones is playing every week. I would have told you like Alvin Kamara played at like 208 last year, like, would you even blink? Like you'd be like, no, all right, sure. Yeah, I buy that. And that's kind of where we are. We're kind of in that where it can swing either direction, but with Williams being more of a committee back in college historically, and then coming out with this physical profile, it doesn't scream to me like Najee Harris does, is like locked in, just full workhorse guy. Now, it still can happen to be that. I still think that that's in his range of outcomes, but that's a big gap to go from 227 to 212. Like, it's not like Etienne going up from like 205 to 215. It's a little different. But this is a guy that can catch the ball. We know that NFL teams value the missed tackle metric. I think we're starting to see that in these drafts. You know, teams really kind of look at that as one of the metrics they kind of really like. And I think that will help Javonte Williams. He was a guy that got a lot of noise early in the process. I think Daniel Jeremiah at one point had him as the first running back taken in the first round. Now I'm not sure we even get a running back in the first round. It still could happen. Like I said, it's weird because I feel like if one of those late round first teams like feel like they want to pass, they might miss out. Like, I think like a team like the Steelers, like I brought them up. If you have a clear need at running back at 24, there's, I think you and I would both agree, there's no reason to take a running back at 24, but they might feel the pressure of, if we don't take a guy at 24, he might not be there at 55. And then they, so they do it. So, I mean, that's kind of where we are, you know, kind of with these top three guys. Like, we could see one of these guys sneak into that back of the first round because the team panics of not being able to wait. Because, like, the Steelers aren't just going to take a guy like the fourth round and say, like, well, this is our guy. It's going to be more of a competition. That guy's going to compete with Anthony McFarlane and Benny Snell and maybe even Jalen Samuels, who they've taken in the fourth and fifth round each of the past 3 years. It's really tough to kind of to gauge. I think Javonte Williams really kind of put us in a gray area with kind of his physical profile. I'm still high on, you know, his production. He doesn't score negatively. It's just, you know, you get bonuses for being collegiate workhorses. Like I said, I did a study on this before where college workhorses tend to be NFL workhorses and committee backs tend to be committee backs. It's something that really doesn't change. The Alabama guy, Josh Jacobs, is really the only exception, you know, kind of recently.
Now, we don't really have enough of a sample probably to really build this into a model, but I think we can say if you're in a committee, it's better to be in a committee with another back who could go in the third round. We're talking about Michael Carter here. I mean, could go in the fifth round. Who knows?
It's a target share argument.
Yeah. So it's like this. It's a similar sort of argument. I like the target share argument. Like, I think it's stronger there for making an adjustment based upon that. But it's there, right? So there is something to that you could build into. But yeah, the weight thing is interesting. When I was comping him, I mean, I think you also had Kerryon Johnson as being like a top comp for, and everyone's going to love that, right?
Everyone hated it. Everyone was like just destroying me.
Yeah, so like he comes up as the top comp for me using like traditional stats when you look at like force missed tackles, Johnson's nowhere close to Williams. And Williams is a guy who he's pretty high, like on our big board, our NFL draft big board, not fantasy big board. Williams is second above Harris because he just grades so damn well because he breaks tackles. And I feel like tackle breaking was something where, I don't know, like it might be overvalued at this point because it is the one thing you can attribute to the running back more so than you know, because the offensive line plays into it, they have the defense, the formations, everything else plays into it. But when a running back breaks a tackle, you could say that's on them more than other guys. I think there has been some guys who've jumped out of nowhere, like a Kareem Hunt, who probably is a lot better than people thought based upon that. But people are starting to catch up to it. And that's why he rates so highly from our grading and from our perspective there. But yeah, with this lower weight, when I'm building together comps, you know, other guys start to show up who were probably seen as being bigger, but weren't really bigger. Like Mark Ingram shows up in there, who was 215. But you also like Clyde Edwards-Helaire can fall in there now. He's only 207 because he's not really that far away. I also got
Trey Mason was in the mix.
No, Sean Moreno went way earlier, but it was 2009, so maybe he's a guy who would have gone a lot later. But I thought he was an interesting type of comp. I mean, we don't really know what he would have been at the NFL level if he didn't have some injuries. And, of course, he was able to produce with Peyton Manning, like, you know, maybe anyone could produce with Peyton Manning. But he's
was one of the best memes still, too, as well.
the tier memes said they're coming through there. So maybe he's a guy in there. But, yeah, I'm definitely a lot less excited, and I do think for Williams, I don't know. I'm still gonna lean a little bit on the fact that his play style means maybe he can be that back and not necessarily read too much into the weight here.
I think okay. Like you, I'm not. I don't want that to sound like I was down on him either.
Right. Yeah. Well. Yeah. You say Kerryon Johnson. You're gonna be. That's why even according to these comps, I was like, you know what? I'm just gonna say no Sean Moreno instead of Kerryon Johnson because I don't want to have to hear the hate mail coming out on that one. Okay. So going into this is the question here is now we're past the big three, which I think everyone has there. Who is next now? You could probably like just jumble up a few guys and throw it in the air and pick out one, and it's not like we're gonna have super strong opinions on there. But you got to stand somewhere on who the next guy is. So who do you have as the fourth running back?
I elevated Trey Sermon to that spot based on we talked about a lot, and the theme is archetypes. And when I compare him to just some of the other guys, I believe that his profile kind of signals more fantasy upside than the other guys, if you were to get it. Because we're in this strike zone anyways here. We're like, we're expecting, we're putting the red flags baked into these guys already.
Yeah.
So we don't need to harp on the negatives for these guys. But I think when you look at from like a positive outcome stance, like he's probably has the highest fantasy ceiling, I believe, out of the next guys of that tier of Gainwell and Michael Carter, who I believe look like just solely committee backs in the NFL. Whereas Sermon, like you can say in a specific outcome, he could kind of be a three down player. One thing I like to go back to with all these prospects at any position is kind of go back and look to where were they regarded coming out of high school. And, Trey Sermon was a guy that was just like an insane recruit out of high school. You know, he had offers from Alabama and Auburn, before he went to Oklahoma. He gets hurt, kind of falls behind. Ramondre Stevenson has to, the transfer, then like the Ohio State is kind of at the beginning of this season, they're playing Master Teague a little bit more. And then Master Teague is out and they have to turn to him. Like he just goes bonkers when everyone's watching the games. You know, the Big Ten title game, he just goes absolutely insane against Northwestern. He crushes against Clemson and he gets hurt right away in the Alabama game, so we didn't get to see him. But when everyone was watching Trey Sermon, he played his best football. I think that definitely elevated his stock. But being 215 pounds, 6 foot, I don't care that he ran slow because that's like he's big, but then you look at like his explosion and agility marks, like those stand out to me. And so I just believe from a ceiling stance, he kind of offers the most of having the most three down upside out of the next tier of guys.
Yeah. I mean, again, when I was doing some of the comp work on him, I mean, so his problem is going to be, he doesn't really have like the production. So if you're
none, like really at all.
Yeah. So if you're going to lean on production heavily,
my model hates him.
Yeah, that's the question, right? So model-based stuff, we're not going to like them too much. Finally, the 2021 NFL Draft Guide is out with 150 player profiles, everything you need to be on top of things well before we get to April when your team is on the clock. You can get it with an Edge or Elite subscription. Use promo code SuperBowl25 and get 25% off those subscriptions. And that promo code is active through Monday after the Super Bowl. That's 25% off an annual Edge or Elite subscription, which includes the 2021 NFL Draft Guide with promo code SuperBowl25. In these uncertain times, life is full of questions, like when should I start thinking about life insurance? But however difficult these questions may be, Western and Southern can help you answer them. Backed by over 130 years of experience, together we can look ahead to leave the unknown behind. Western and Southern Financial Group, life insurance, retirement, and investments. Compensated endorser, products issued by member companies of Western and Southern Financial Group, Cincinnati, Ohio. I mean, it almost, it's like one of the most interesting, it's like, it's amazing how much hype this guy has. Without jiggering anything around, when I threw it in there, Christine Michael came out as his top comp that he had, which is another guy where he never really got more than like 15, 16 carries a game. Mm-hmm. He's a little bit bigger at 220. He was a little bit faster, but similar explosion. I mean, he had a ridiculous vert, but similar broad, similar three cone also too. Both these guys tested really well at the three cone. So kind of an athletic guy who wasn't super fast. So that falls in there. The rest of his comps, I mean, it's just a lot of guys who were drafted later because of the fact that they didn't really have that much production. I mean, a guy who was drafted earlier was someone like a Sony Michel, but even that was like a committee back sort of situation there, and he's probably used a little bit more in the passing game despite the fact that he's been totally absent from that as a pro. So yeah, I can see Sermon, but I can also see the argument for maybe some red flags, especially from the analytical crowd.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, absolutely. Like I said, my model has him like RB 15, 16 in that area. because like you said, there's just no production. There's no production to latch onto. And we talk about all the time, like production in college is a signal for production in the NFL. I had guys like Cameron Artis Payne, Chris Carson, Alfred Morris, Jonathan Williams from Arkansas, who some people liked at the time, came up in like his comps. Yeah, just not a lot of production, committee backs. Same boat. But I think when I compare him to, like I said, the secondary tier of guys, I can talk myself into an outcome where he's more of a feature back than some of these other guys.
Yeah, but I definitely agree. And you're right that he has this Ohio State prospect, great prospect type of resume there. And people still care about that stuff. We maybe talk about that with some other prospects later, how much people care about this. All right, so who do we have as next?
I have Kenneth Gainwell next just because I believe that even if he fails as a running back, he's that good of a receiver that like he's still going to have an out in the NFL. Maybe he eventually changes positions. He was recruited as a wide receiver to Memphis. And, you know, Memphis has played a number of these kind of like, you know, all jack of all trade guys and their wide open offense. Tony Pollard, you know, Antonio Gibson of recent years. He's much smaller than those guys, which is the problem. And when you look at his size, and he was a guy too that weighed more than what he was listed as. You know, he went from 190 to 202, where you say that's a big jump, but it still doesn't change his archetype. You know,
yeah, that was something I was that was a big thing for me. Like I saw that. I was like, oh, OK, 201. And then I put it in. I'm like, it doesn't really change, unfortunately. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the unfortunate part where, you know, Tony Pollard was 210 at the combine. Antonio Gibson was 228, you know, was absolutely, you know, fit the physical profile you were looking for, especially from, you know, what else he did at the combine athletically as well. There's a lot more intrigue there. And you say a guy with this physical profile, 228 pounds and catch balls, this return resume. All right. I'll be a little excited here. But I think this receiving floor is great. You know, obviously last time we seen him, he caught over 50 balls at Memphis, like I said, recruited as a wide receiver. Interesting enough, like his like agility and like explosion numbers are trash. They're garbage. And that kind of goes with the weight thing. So he's kind of a tweener. He might be a positionless player eventually in the NFL. But I'm just counting on the receiving floor. But like I said, like you brought up with Sermon, I mean, it's really easy to just cone in on the red flags to the rest of these guys. It really is. But like you said, someone has to go into these slots.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so this is the thing I would say. I think like Gainwell was someone I thought legitimately, potentially RB4, you know, definitely RB5, maybe RB6 at a floor. But then I started thinking about it from a different perspective, and it was like, you know, I'm building these comps in here. I'm getting like Isaiah Pede, like Ito Smith, Nyheim Hines type of guys in here, and it's just like, is there a reason at this point in rookie drafts to say, you know what, like he has a better floor than some other guys, but let's just go for a guy who might, even if the comps are far few and far between of having a comp who can be very successful, maybe just go for that guy. And again, not worry about wasting the pick.
Yeah, so I actually should have probably led with this. So in my pre-draft, like overall rankings, we talked about the big three. I don't have my RB4 all the way until 20th overall. We brought up Sermon's Meyer before. I don't have him until in non-superflex. This is non-superflex ranks. I don't have him until 20th. So we have the top three guys, and then I just have a massive jump where like I'm just not interested in these running backs. Maybe someone in draft capital, you know, breaks the bank and can climb over some of these receivers that might slide in draft capital. But from just a top-down objective perspective heading to this draft, we have a really seismic gap of to where I value these guys. We're now in late second round rookie pick territory for me.
Yeah. I guess it's like how do you want to deploy those darts? Because I can see like there's value in getting someone who can, you know, spot start and in a PPR league and get some catches and do other things. Like there's value having that guy on your roster. There's also the idea of maybe you're just like I said, throwing a dart in a different fashion. And we can, the problem is there aren't a lot of these guys available in this class. You're throwing a dart in a different fashion for a bigger guy who may be able to get you more of the three down potential, even if it's a low probability event. It's something that's within the range of outcomes. So let's talk about some of these. So I think the top five are big here. Amongst the next few, is there anyone that really stands out? Maybe not going one by one, but I think Carter is probably another name. Michael Carter is another name there where it fits into a similar sort of bucket. Is there anything about him that's changed your opinion on where he should be ranked?
No, not really. I mean, he totally looks top down to be like the, you know, James White, Chase Edmonds, you know, guy in the NFL. Like, a committee back can be productive, solid rushing resume. I mean, that's just what I believe he is, the Duke Johnson type, you know, like that's what I think he's going to be in the NFL. He's probably going to be a guy that has, you know, more of a receiving profile. He's one of those guys that has more collegiate carries than he did in the NFL. I totally, totally believe that. Probably the most interesting guy for me in like the secondary bucket that I like, but I just have no idea where he's going to be drafted. So I don't have him like super highly ranked is Kylan Hill. Yeah. I think he has the most intriguing profile out of these guys. I don't have him higher than Carter and Gainwell, cause I believe that those guys are just going to have higher draft capital than him. Maybe I'll come out surprised and then I'll be tremendously positive on him, but I just don't know where the hell he's gonna go. I mean, he's just, it's all over the place. I don't know. But he was one of the guys I thought throughout the process, like, kept like kind of looking more interesting in this class. You know, he was, you know, 5'10, 214. He has a pass catching background, you know, decent speed score, real solid explosion score, not really great agility score, but you know, he can catch the football, which we like from these guys. And then, like you said, he has that size upside to maybe if he's a fifth round pick and you're 214 pounds, you end up breaking out as a tweener. You know, we can go in any direction. Whereas we brought up Gainwell and Carter, I don't think that there's, outside of a team necessity, like opened up through injuries, like a team's going to give him a bunch of touches. Whereas Kylin Hill could be one of those guys that kind of works his way into more touches over the course of his NFL career. So he's the most interesting guy, I think, of the secondary tier for me. Like I said, I just have no idea where he's going to go.
Yeah, I think the problem with Gainwell and Carter is like, it's even beyond that. It's like, even if there are injuries, they may not get the lion's share of the touches. Whereas I feel like Kylin Hill is the guy where, with an injury, maybe could get the lion's share of touches. Like, I still don't think he's just going to be plugged in there type of guy. It's weird. Like, the first comp that I had for him was Mike Davis. And I think that's like a perfect example of a guy where everyone's like, you know, he's whatever. He's not a top pick sort of guy. But if you had to use him and you had to deploy him and you wanted to use every skill set that he has, then he can be productive. And that's what a lot of these NFL running backs are. So that's why I am very interested in Hill, even versus Gainwell and others, just because of that fact that maybe he can really kind of stumble into being a guy who comes in and totes the rock a little bit more. I guess I'm trying to think of who else we have on here. Didn't quite have as good of a receiving profile, but like Wayne Gallman fits in there. Another guy where he didn't do much, but at least he was given a chance, right? For a couple of games with injury to be that guy. And I think that's maybe a little bit interesting. I'd say Zach Stacy is another guy that I have down there. RIP. He was a great rookie season. Inefficient, but great rookie season. Great volume season from Zach Stacy back in the day. So, yeah, I definitely think Hill is very interesting for that reason. Who else do we have on here that I want to talk about? Let me just scroll down your old rankings. Go see this. Did anything happen with Chuba Hubbard? I was a little disappointed in his testing. He's one of the few guys where I really wanted to see him burn because I felt like he was a sprinter. He made all these long plays when he was in his last season and he's also this weird guy where, like, if he comes out after the 2,000-yard season, what happens? Like, where is he ended up drafted versus where he's going to be drafted now, which is probably not until day three.
Yeah, he had a falling out with the coaching staff there too last year, some off-field stuff. So did Kylin Hill, who ended up opting out at one point. You know, he had a real big falling out with the coaching staff. But if Hubbard, the million-dollar question is like, just if he comes out last year, where we talked about where this might have worked out for Harris, it really kind of hurt Hubbard, right? Like coming back. He might not have gone high in that gaggle of running backs last year. And when we saw the testing maybe last year too, it wouldn't have been as high and we would have cooled down. Maybe that was part of the process as well. But if he comes out last year off of that production, he has more life, right? More pulse. Seeing last year kind of happen is just kind of a red flag. He's a guy that's kind of a home run or nothing type of runner too.
Yeah.
Which at the NFL level, like if you're running a 4.5, like it's hard for us to really bank on that. You being a home run kind of runner, you know, in the NFL. He has that track background, kind of disappointed. Tylan Wallace did the same thing. Tylan Wallace was like a high school long jumper and like came out and had like one of the worst broad jumps of any wide receiver. It's like, what's happening, man? I know he had the ACL injury, but, yeah, Hubbard just really hurt his stock. I still like, he's like a tweener, you know, 206 foot, 210 pounds. It's not like the speed score like was detrimental. Like it still is okay for a size, but like you said, everyone was anticipating it to be the hallmark of his profile. Everyone expecting him to run a 4.4 or like a 4.38 or something crazy and be like a Tevin Coleman type. And now we can't even really treat him as a Tevin Coleman type.
Yeah, I mean, they're just like handing out 4.38s left and right over here. And initially tweets came out saying he ran a 4.38. I remember this because I was on vacation and then like an idiot, I like quote tweet that and I was like, well, this is a 4.38 I can believe because he's a sprinter. And then like people are jumping in and they're like, no, it's 4.48 officially, you know, like laughing at me. LOL, a lot of LOLs going on here. And so then I was like, that's not good because he doesn't grade well for us because he does not have this broken tackle profile. He has the home run hitter profile, which If he ran faster, I would say could be undervalued. Like some of these guys are undervalued that can make their own way but not break a tackle and that sort of thing, can gain those incremental yards. But yeah, that was painful and dropped him down for me. Let's just go through, rather than go through every single player on here, a couple guys that I'm going to just go throw at you I think are interesting. Khalil Herbert is interesting only because he's big, but he just shows nothing in the receiving game. So what do we think about him? When I see him play, though, I could see him kind of running one of these wide zone type of schemes the way that he's been there. And he just came out of nowhere last year breaking off these long runs. And he's big enough, he's fast enough to maybe get into that sort of mold, but he didn't show anything receiving. And I think he showed a little bit receiving in the Senior Bowl, which people thought, of course, that happens for a lot of guys. They're like, oh, they can catch when they're given a chance. But when they're not used in that way, it's a little concerning.
Yeah, I'm not as down on his receiving profile just because, well, one, so Khalil Herbert played at Kansas, yeah, which was just a cesspool. It was like an absolute cesspool of collegiate football in the past like three seasons. Just what a joke of a program it was. But he also played alongside Puka Williams, who was used in that role. You know, the Dexter McCluster role that he looks like. Puka Williams also hit me with like an all-time like heartbreak betting moment last year. Kansas was just so dreadful. They couldn't set lines high enough, and they played against West Virginia, and the line was 21.5 points. And I was just at that point laying anything against Kansas. And he ran a meaningless kickoff back with 1 minute left of the game to cut the score to 21 and ruin the bet, and then opted out the week after. But because Puka Williams at Kansas, you know, Khalil Herbert never got this runway last year. So he transfers, goes to Virginia Tech. They actually give him an opportunity. You know, not like a massive opportunity. He still is under 170 touches because that's kind of like we said, he's a tweener profile guy. He's 210. But he just rips off just nothing but explosive plays last year. 8.2 yards per touch, the highest of all running backs in this class. Just went just bonkers and turning in big plays. And that's kind of what he is. He's what we thought, I think, we wanted Chuba Hubbard to be. From a big play stance and being able to kind of have a profile that checked out to kind of roll over there, because he actually didn't completely brick, you know, his comment. He ran a 4.48, had really crummy explosion scores though, looking at it, and then not the agility score. So that's what you have. You give him a tarmac, he's going to make a big play. And if not, like, it's probably not going to be a big play, but he's an interesting guy too, as well. I believe at his spot, I do think there's some receiving upside with him still. I don't know if I want to use upside the right word, but I think that there's receiving acumen. Like, he's able to catch a football.
The way he ran, I mean, there's not really a good comp that I can come up with that's like not overhyping him a little bit too much, because he had like these ridiculously long runs. You're going to look at him and you say, like, he's kind of like, he reminded me a little bit of maybe like a broke man's Nick Chubb or something like that, and how he was running, but it's very broke. You're broke. I mean, you're like, you're destitute. A destitute man.
His top comp for me was Anthony McFarland, and it was like a light bulb moment. I was like, oh damn, I realized, like, yeah, oh, I have a type now. Like, because thinking about Anthony McFarland and why I liked him coming out of Maryland was like those home run balls, that big playability, and just saying, like, well, if he can come any type of consistent back or just get some touches to mix in, like, he could be that. And seeing Khalil Herbert and Anthony McFarland be so close on my comp list, I was like, oh, okay.
Okay, well, let's wrap this up here with, say, like, do you have any long shot guys that we should be prioritizing here? I know you were, is your Jamar Jefferson love still intact, or has it been mitigated by, I guess his pro day wasn't great, but I don't know if it matters that much, just for the fact that maybe he's not even drafted at this point, I guess.
Yeah, so I moved him way down on just the logic of, like, I mean, he's definitely going to be a day three guy, if that, and now, like, is he even draftable? Like, will a team even view him as draftable? That's why I moved him way down, you know, trying to have some foresight on capital. He's not going to have the capital some of these other guys did. I do really like his production profile. I mean, as a true freshman at age 18, I mean, he was bonkers, had 1,500 yards, you know, 12 touchdowns. Also, I believe, I don't have this metric handy, because you might, working for Pro Football Focus, but I have to believe that he was one of the highest running backs in terms of attempts versus stack boxes. I mean, this this Oregon State offense was just complete garbage last year, and all they had to do every play, every game, was just be able to hand him the football. And that's why you've seen him break some long runs, because teams are selling out to stop the run against Oregon State, because they know they don't respect the pass. And, you know, when you clear the second level on some of these stack box runs, that's when you end up getting with explosive plays. And that's why he had some of those kind of stand out. But I'm still,
I don't know that exactly, but they're like a bottom 10th percentile team blocking grade. So that plays into it a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he was guys a freshman too, that caught passes. He had 25 catches as a freshman at age 18. So I'm still into the production profile. I'm more hesitant on just like the draft capital profile, but he's a guy I still will take some late round dart throws, because he still is an early declare. But he also came in lighter than I thought he was going to be too. You know, he's another guy. He came in at 206. Like, if he's hanging around 210, 212, you have more room to go up or down. Like, you know what I mean? You at least have the option to say, like, all right, well, if he plays a little bit heavier, or he gets an opportunity. Like, 206 is more in that range of like, okay, like it's more of a gray area. Like, can he get to touches or just be stuck in a committee? Definitely will still throw some darts, intrigued on the production profile, but very cooled off on just the anticipation that he could very much not be drafted at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. I have Miles Gaskin for his.
See, so did I. I had Gaskin as a high comp, and then, there was another Pac-12 running back that popped too, off the top of my head. His name's elusive to me, but now I was like, oh, maybe Pac-12 just has like these guys that can pop later. It's off the tip of my tongue. Oh, it was Kadeem Carey. Yeah. Kadeem Carey was the other guy.
Yeah, I remember. He was like he was a guy that people were excited about from a production standpoint, and then he ran like the worst 40 ever or something, though, right? Wasn't he like
he ran a 4.7.
Yeah, it was like approaching 4.7 at not so heavy. So yeah, I mean, just to reiterate the pro day that we're talking about here for Jefferson. So you mentioned the 206. So it was the 4.55 40, which isn't horrible, but the periphery sort of stuff, the vertical at 31 inches is like 10th percentile, the broad 115, 25th percentile. The three cone 7.38, which is probably juiced, like, cuz this is a pro day. 8th percentile with a potentially juice. So yeah, just you're just not going to get excited. Well, I want to talk about a guy on the flip side of it, because this is a guy you're pretty low on, but I'm like higher on knowing I'm probably going to be disappointed, and I probably wouldn't pick him post draft. And that's Chris Evans from Michigan, because I feel like someone could talk themselves into this guy, because he did perform really well at his pro day. He was like good as a freshman. He was a guy who was making some. He was a decent recruit coming out. Supposedly at the Senior Bowl, he was one of these guys who really impressed as far as being able to catch the ball and looked more dialed in. He may have been a little bit of a head case sort of situation. Obviously suspended for a year. He was out for a year in college. So my only thing about him is maybe someone could talk themselves into him in like the third round or something like that. Maybe it's within the realm of possibility, despite the fact that like this guy really has no production.
Plus the Harbaugh discount. I mean, just go through Harbaugh's resume of 4- and 5-star skill player recruits at Michigan that one just transferred. The amount of guys that transferred that he recruited as 4- and 5-star guys is just insane. And then the amount of wasted talent there. Then you have a guy like Chris Evans, who basically got phased out of that offense. Even though it's like on a per touch basis, he was pretty good every year at Michigan.
Yeah.
Just never ran into a lot of touches. Because like, I mean, we can easily just kind of, there might be like a Harbaugh discount on all these guys. Even Donovan Peoples-Jones had a productive, you know, rookie season for a 6th round pick. A year ago for the Browns. I mean, there might be something to this, you know, what went down at Michigan over Harbaugh's, you know, initial run here.
Yeah, I mean, Evans had 16 rushing attempts last year.
Yes. And I mean, it's pretty bonkers to think about.
It's like, this is a guy, I mean, he had 600 yards as a freshman. He went a little bit further as a sophomore, which was kind of a disappointing jump. And then it was like, see you later. You know, went down to 400 yards on 81 attempts, out for the year, barely doing anything. He graded pretty well when he actually got some chances, but just such a low volume sort of thing that like looking at any efficiency stat is difficult for him because he doesn't have any volume.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I could definitely see a team talking themselves into him, and even, you know, I know some draft Knicks like him, and some guys that I respect like him as a player as well. Like you said, he was a high recruit too. So obviously being a high recruit, you're not going to be just a complete vagabond. It's just like almost impossible to have any expectations though. It's just, like you said, if you if you want to take like a fourth round rookie pick, just that shoot your shot. That's the only reason I'm so low on him in rankings, is just because I just have no expectations like for a guy as this kind of profile.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I did some comps, Daniel Lasco, if you remember him, showed up in there. He was the total workout warrior. He was even better. Like, he was even like a little, I mean, Evans had a 40 and a half vert. I think Lasco was like 41 and a half or 42. Lasco was over 11 feet, I believe, at the broad jump, where Evans was good, 10 feet, 7 inches, 6'5", 6", 3-cone. I don't know. I'm questioning that a little bit. Like, I don't know. That's a little fast. I'm questioning the finger. The thumb may not have been, maybe they're using thumb instead of the index finger on that one, because that seems a little bit fast. But again, the difference between him and Lasco is that, like, he has this perception of pedigree, right? And I feel like that, with this pro day that people can fall in love with and Senior Bowl that people can fall in love with, could all combine to get some sort of like absurd draft capital that people aren't expecting. So that would be my
thing. Yeah, I totally agree.
Is there anyone that I missed here that you think is interesting?
Well, I think if there's listeners, they probably would real quick just like us to talk about Jarrett Patterson and Javion Hawkins. But I think for the for the same reasons we haven't touched upon them are going to be very similar. I mean, you're just not going to talk me into a 5'8", 180 pound running back. You're just not. I respect Javion Hawkins is fast and he can make it. You're just not. I'm just not going to be talked into a 180 pound running back. I think there's definitely some exciting plays. And when you have a running back that's 5'8", 180, like, he's aesthetically, he's going to look fun, right? He's just, because he's not getting kind of like bruising runs and doing stuff. So I get it. And Jarrett Patterson, you know, obviously, you know, everyone loves him because he had that, you know, insane DFS game, the 8-touchdown game last year. And I think he had a 2-game stretch where he actually ran for like 600 yards or something like insane. But the same thing, 5'6", 195 pounds. Like, that's just not a profile that I'm going to invest in. Someone's going to always like that in my rookie draft more than I do.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where you could try to say, I mean, we're always a year late on everything, right? So it'd be like, oh, who's the James Robinson this year? Oh, Jarrett Patterson. Yeah, he's just not big enough. Like, I'm sorry. Like, it's just not going to. It's just not going to happen for that reason. I guess one other guy I'll mention. You don't seem very high on Ramondre Stevenson. The only reason
I'm fine with him though.
In a very shortened season, you know, he did catch like three. I think he had 3 receptions a game in a very shortened season here. So he didn't look great catching the ball, but maybe there's something there. And he's just really he's big. He's a big dude. He's not particularly fast, but he's not like abysmally slow.
Yeah, I think when it comes to Ramondre Stevenson, you know, my model likes him more than I do. I'm below the model rank on him, but I just like see a profile where like he's going to have to score a lot of touchdowns. And like those guys are always really tough to kind of bank on in the NFL. But definitely from a size perspective, I think he's going to go higher than people think he will. Like, I actually do believe he will be drafted higher than like the analytic Twitter is. They'll be upset. Like, they'll be like, oh, like when he gets drafted, you'll see probably a flood of stuff like, I can't believe they took this dude, this turtle. You know, he's so big and he's so slow. But, you know, from a size perspective, there just aren't a lot of big backs in this class. And the team just is going to want that guy to like just come, especially with going to 17 games in a season. Like, this guy's going to have some value over the course of a season. When we talk about load management for your backfields, like, this is a guy that can come in and take some load management, come in on 3rd and 2. Come in on, you know, 2nd and 4 or whatever, you know, and be a banger or take goal line carries from like a guy that maybe is not a bigger back on your roster. I think that an NFL team is actually going to like him more than the analytical crowd.
Yeah. I mean, and it was one of those things where without trying too hard to put something ridiculous out there, when I did put him into the model, Arian Foster did come up as the number one cup. But then again, Arian Foster was a really bad prospect. So it's like, you know, It's a flip side. Like, he wasn't a good prospect. He was undrafted. He didn't have production. He was slow. But he did, you know, show something in the receiving game as a college prospect. But, you know, hoping for that going future for the future for Stevenson is kind of ridiculous. But I'll still lean on that just because you need to attract some eyeballs some way. So
open to it. I mean, if you were to say like, we don't expect there to be a James Robinson's class, and I don't expect Stevenson to be undrafted, but for a rookie running back that we think would outseed expectations based on, you know, where most people have ranked in capital, I don't think Stevenson is like a bad bet. Like, we don't expect it to happen, so you're not going to bet on it to happen. But, like, if there was a guy, like, I would say, like, you know, based on his size and scoring ability and, like you said, just a little bit of displayed receiving ability, like, he kind of is in that mold.
Yeah, yeah. And he's a guy where he's huge, but he wasn't really, like, a bruiser. Also, he was kind of weird. Like, he wasn't a broken tackle run through you type of guy. So I don't know if NFL teams like that. We'll see. We'll see.
Well, remember, people thought he was going to be like 250.
Yeah.
Like, because they listed him at, I think, like 243 or 247. And he ended up being 227, which was more palatable for a lot of people. But a lot of people were expecting him to be like this, like, enormous dude.
Yeah. So we'll see. If he fell, he could fall into the right situation. Again, just having that size, not necessarily great from an NFL value perspective, but we're looking at fantasy. We're looking at, you know, we're hoping for those outlier outcomes. All right, man. This was great. Follow Rich on Twitter, as you probably already are, at Lord Reeves. What else we got coming into draft season? Should we be looking out for?
Right now, me and Dan Pizzuta are walking through, like, every NFL roster, offensive and defensively, for, like, an NFL need stance. Because this is kind of like a dead period for fantasy. So we're focused more on the NFL draft team need stance. I'll probably will drop an article around some of these player comps that you heard on here. I do every year, because we didn't even talk about any wide receiver ones, and those ones draw a lot more attention because they have a lot more variance to them. People get a lot more triggered by wide receiver comps than running back comps. When you have some, like, because you said, it's always prospect based, so people say, like, oh, this guy's a pro, is complete trash, and they'll flip out. But I will drop some player comps over here in the next couple weeks before the NFL draft on those. But really just looking forward to the NFL draft, getting some landing spot on these guys, and then moving to the next phase of the offseason.
Yeah. The wide receiver comps are tough because, like, draft position isn't necessarily as important for wide receivers or not, but you just don't get these, like, late round guys who randomly luck into being great players. Like, it's just, there's a lot of guys that I'm doing these comp pieces where it's like you list the 10 top comps and it's like a big thud. There's, like, literally nothing that shows up there. Whereas sometimes with running backs, you can get guys that just randomly show up because they're given an opportunity. And with wide receivers, I'm sorry, you know, you're day three wide receiver, you're probably not doing anything in the NFL. That's just that's just the way it goes. But anyway, thanks so much again. Like I said, I've exploited you here for another episode, so I appreciate that. Next week I'm going to come back. I'm going to talk to our mutual friend JJ Zacharyson about wide receivers, which will probably go on for like 2 hours, going through all the guys in an exciting class this year. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks.